Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. I'm excited to host as today's guest, Jerome Pacenti, Vice President of AI at Facebook. At Facebook, Jerome leads the development of artificial intelligence. He oversees hundreds of scientists and engineers impacting Facebook's direction, as well as the future of our world. Jerome, I'm looking forward to getting an inside look at what you're doing at Facebook and your work. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start off with some stage setting. Most people are familiar with the work of Facebook, but less familiar with what Facebook is doing with artificial intelligence. So how and where is Facebook using AI, and how do these fit into Facebook's overall business strategy?
We really do three different things in AI. So one is we are using AI to protect, connect, and empower users. And I'll give you an example of three. Connecting is, you know, when you fire up the app, you know, that's Instagram or the Facebook app, what you see there is actually determined by a pretty sophisticated machine learning algorithm. It tries to understand who you are and what you're interested in, and tries to find content that matches your interest. And the goal of this algorithm is to bring long-term value to you as a user. The second thing we do is we try to protect people with AI. So as I'm sure you know, we have major moderation challenges in the platform, right? We need to make sure that the billions of users that use our platform use it according to our policies. And it's not possible to do that just through humans. So we have actually 30,000 people dedicated to monitoring the platform, but they cannot do that on their own. And they're really assisted through AI today. And so we have an algorithm that every time you post something on the platform, will actually analyze that it's either text or images or video, analyze what you're posting, and making sure that it satisfies the policy around pornography or hate speech or violent content, and try to do that automatically. And if it cannot decide on its own, we'll hand it over to humans to figure out whether or not it satisfies our policy. And then the last thing we do is we use AI to really try to drive new experiences, you know, give new powers to people. One example of that is the company is very invested in what we call augmented reality. And you cannot, you know, create good augmented reality experience without AI at the core. So this is a big area of investment for us, is to develop AI that will enable people to interact with, you know, a set of glasses seamlessly and for the glasses to understand the world around them. But in a little shorter term, we also launched a product like Facebook Portal. I don't know if you've ever tried it. It's a video conference device and it has a smart camera in it. And the camera is able to follow you around and able to determine where you are or multiple people in the picture without having to resume what you're doing. So that's kind of the three things we do with AI. We, you know, protect people, making sure that the content is posted is according to our policy. We connect them to content and to other people, and then we try to empower them with new abilities.
And I'd love to do some double clicking on each of these items. They're all very fascinating areas. So in the first aspect of connecting and empowering users, how does AI work to optimize our newsfeed, or what is it that we're seeing, or who is it that we're connected with?
So we are trying to use whatever signal you give to us. And so the signal can come through your interaction through the platform of like the content you have liked, the people you have friended, the content you have posted. We also get some content from some signal from third parties that actually are interested in having a more understanding of you and making sure that when they advertise to the platform, they actually get more targeted advertising. So there's one part of thing, which is, hey, collecting this content to understand who you are. And then the other part is analyzing the content that's added to the platform, you know, figuring out what it's about, what are the interests, and figure out if these two match, you know. And the goal is really to optimize for long-term interest in that content.
And so one of the, I guess, concerns or fears around that optimization is that people may be put into a bubble without even realizing that they're in a bubble. And I'm curious what you would say in response.
I think it's a good concern, right? And it's something that we're paying a lot of attention to, right? So I think traditionally, the metrics and the objective functions that were used for this algorithm were all around short-term engagement. So the challenge with this short-term engagement is that they tend to favor things that you will respond quickly to. And so that tends to actually kind of like create a loop of reinforcing the things that you go naturally towards. Okay? So I think that's the concern you had is true, which is if you optimize for short-term engagement, people will tend to react and want to see what the things they have seen in the past, right? So the question is to kind of like step back from that and try to get objective function that are not just on short-term engagement, but look at longer-term signal. For example, will you come back to the app, you know, a month from now? Or if we ask you the question, you know, did you find this interaction valuable? Did it make you more informed? Did it teach you something? So we are looking at optimizing for other things than just short-term engagement to avoid this kind of bad feedback loop, if you want.
Right. And then on the second point, you talk about analyzing content. So deepfakes for misinformation, potentially. I think that's something that there's been a lot of concern about, especially in the upcoming elections. I know that Facebook's been working very hard to address this. Can you comment again on some of these concerns, some of the challenges and the measures that are being taken?
Yeah, so I think our goal, right, is to make sure that the content, you know, satisfies our policy. So my team doesn't set the policies. You know, the company sets the policy and work with some outside actors to do that as well. But the goal is, can you try to make sure most of the content on the platform satisfies this policy automatically? And so we need to analyze the content holistically, you know, what's in the text, what is the information shared, what's in the image, and look collectively as to, you know, is it satisfying the policy or not? And training it on some example that we got from the past. So there are lots of challenges. As you can imagine, that's a very difficult task, even for humans, because humans make also mistakes as they do this. But we are improving AI, you know, constantly. So I can tell you a little bit about the type of AI problem we're solving. One aspect is that you need to look at the totality of the information, right? Not just one modality, not just the text, not just the metadata, not just the image, but look at it together, right? Making sure that, you know, when you look at all the signal, it actually satisfies or breaks a policy. It's especially tricky when you look sometimes at images and with text overlaid or the content. It's really the context that will tell you if the post is actually policy validating or not.
Like memes, for example. Like memes are very difficult.
Memes, yes.
Right? Because they're both text and visual.
That's right. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that this is a kind of problem that the academic community has not really looked towards. You know, they're not paying a lot of attention to this kind of problem. And so what we've done is invested in creating data sets for that community to get invested in. You know, for the community out there to get, you know, involved, the problem is often a lack of data, right? So they want to find an interesting problem, but if they have no data attached to it, it's hard for them to get involved. That's why we created the deepfake detection challenge, and then recently the admin challenge, which is where we actually created the synthetic data sets that represented some example of fake videos and some example of hate memes, and then let people basically provide the best algorithm possible to solve these challenges.
And can you talk a little bit about that? So, you know, these multimodal challenges for memes, for example, like irony would be very difficult to detect potentially, right? Because irony depends on the contrast between what is being written or stated and what the picture actually shows. And are you finding, like, is it enough to have enough data sets, or does there need to be more nuance around training the algorithms?
So first, we have made a lot of progress, right? So even if you take a concept like irony, the language understanding systems have just improved tremendously in the past 5 years, right? So even if you just look at the text itself, our ability to detect this kind of subtle human emotions, if you want, or
intentions,
yeah, some intentions, has evolved tremendously. It's definitely not perfect. And as you mentioned, often the subtlety comes not just from the text, but the combination of the text and the image. So this is where we come up with new algorithm that actually train both sides at the same time, right? So it's actually one network, if you want, that takes as input both the text and the image, and the output is whether the post is policy validating. So instead of trying to understand each in isolation, you really train a system that combines both.
And what are some of the challenges of training the system?
Well, you know, obviously one challenge is to figure out how to combine these modalities, because an image looks very different than text. So then we have little tricks to do that. Actually, the beauty of neural network is that they're kind of easy to combine. So it's possible to take different modality and end up representing them in a common space. And then after, you can run classifiers on top of that, that kind of understand both at the same time. So that's the beauty of neural network, that they kind of allow to take any kind of input and ultimately convert into this kind of, you know, gigantic embeddings, which are these high dimension vectors that after you can treat kind of in a similar way and combine, and then run another network on top of that to classify whether, you know, it's in certain intention or another.
That was interesting. So you're actually finding that this challenge of working in multimodal functions is not as insurmountable as we might otherwise think.
No, I mean, actually, we have the tools to do that, right? After, the challenge, obviously, is that you need to get a deep enough understanding to be able to find these sort of things, right? So we're constantly trying to improve how you actually learn from these two monoliths at the same time. We're also constantly trying to improve like the data that we use to train the system. In particular, what we're trying to do is learn more and more in a self-supervised way, right? So one of the challenges is to find the labeling data for this kind of problems. And what we found, and I think not just us, but the industry as a whole, is techniques like self-supervision are much better to do this kind of thing.
Great. And so then the goal is understanding the content that's being posted and being able to react immediately, whether that means taking it down immediately or otherwise.
That's right. I mean, it's basically you try to understand it. Once you have an understanding, you try to figure out if it breaches some of our policies. And you can use that common representation after to basically apply it to all the different policies you have. And then obviously the idea is either you flag it or you act on it automatically, depending on the level of confidence you have on that assessment.
So we talk a lot about these reactive uses of artificial intelligence. So being protective and AI and safety and, you know, misinformation and deepfakes. But then there's also the positive side of using this technology. And Facebook does seem to be pioneering in this multimodal mixed media content space in general. And I'd love to hear more about kind of your vision. I know you've recently taken on your role at Facebook to accelerate the growth in artificial intelligence. Like, what are some of your priorities and the areas of focus and ways you want to grow the technology there?
That's a good call out. I'd say, you know, in a place like Facebook, AI has been used tremendously for the past, you know, few years already, and it's growing very fast. But it's not necessarily very visible to the end user. Now, what we find in the past 2 years is there's really a wealth of new use cases that are coming up where AI is really at the core of the experience, right? And so that's a big focus. I mean, you ask me like, well, how I see my team and our effort growing, that's actually, I would say, the biggest line of progress and potential at the moment, which is, hey, how can you reinvent the interaction with humans with AI at the core to make it more seamless, to make it more natural, to make it more valuable to them?
So can you talk a bit about what that looks like, those interactions with humans? This is beyond just the regular platform, but some of the other new experiences you're talking about, augmented reality and even the portal.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, let me first describe the one I mentioned earlier. You know, portal is a fairly straightforward one, but it's a kind of neat one, which is the system, you know, basically like see who you are in the pictures or run all on device. So it's a video conference system and it has a camera, and the camera actually doesn't move, but it just has a wide angle camera. And so you can see kind of everybody that's in the room if you want. And then it can parse the image on device in real time and figure out, hey, who are the humans in the room and where are they? And then it would actually zoom the camera automatically to make sure that it actually focused as much as possible on the human in the image. And it's done completely privately because it's all done on device. No actually information leaves the device that you're using. So that's just one example where it allows actually for much more natural interaction, because I don't know if you ever interacted with your maybe like older parents and they don't quite know how to use your phone and you try to do a video phone conference call and you always see like a piece of the head. With a device like this, you know, I'd say it's awesome. I use it to interact with my mother, and you know, it really changed the experience. It make it much more natural, much higher quality. So that's one, I would say, little example.
Yeah, especially since we've all moved to video conferencing. So that'll really enhance our experience together.
Another example of usage of that is, you know, when you do classes of our video, I'm actually, you know, taking training classes. You know, I have a trainer and I do that remotely with her. And so when I go around and doing my exercise, actually the camera can follow me, right? I don't have to move the device and figure out whether I'm in the picture or not. It actually does that automatically. So that's one little example. But ultimately the vision we have, right, for this kind of system is to really understand everything that's in the picture. So imagine now you have AR glasses, right, that you're wearing. And the key is, you know, how can this glasses interact and understand the world around you in a very precise manner, right? So imagine like you put your keys somewhere and then you want to ask the device, hey, where did I put my keys? The system would have had to understand that, oh, okay, you are having your keys at one point, identify that, you put them somewhere, and I can remember that. And you want to do that all this completely privately and on device, right? Without information going to the cloud. So that's the kind of challenges that we're trying to address today. And so that's an experience where the system can understand everything around you and kind of assist you in any other task. Another example is how would you actually interact with that device, right? So today people are used to Alexa or used with Google Home, but the interaction with this device is a bit contrived, right? So you ask them a question, it's kind of transactional. You tell, okay, what's the weather today? Or, you know, how long is it going to take me to actually drive somewhere? But really you'd like to have more of a companion, some computer where you can interact more naturally. And so today we actually are able to create AI where you can converse with that AI. And so you can have a lot more natural conversation. But this AI today is a little bit harder to control. So there's still some work that needs to be done. But I expect that in the next few years, we'll have interactions that are much more natural than they are today, you know, much more conversational.
And what do you think are those early uses going to be? So right now for Google Home, we use it for things like give me a recipe. But what is your hope for the uses of this more nuanced artificial intelligence?
Well, I think one will be that just the interaction, right, is much more natural. So instead of having just a single step interaction, which we have today, you can really refine your interaction with the device, right? You can start having a conversation where the system will remember who you are, what you have asked in the past, and put that in that context. And you can also have a conversation where you have actually context as you go, right? So if you want to book your vacation or organize it, right, you can't do that in just one domain, right? You have to have a succession of demand. So that's one aspect where the level of interaction with the device is a lot more interactive, a lot more complicated, requires multiple inputs to be put at the same time. That's one aspect. The other aspect is more around actual conversation. It sounds more like a buddy or someone you like to interact with, right? That you have a conversation, which can be entertaining rather than something purely transactional, right? So something that has, you know, a personality, someone that you like interacting with, someone that can entertain you and help you figure out entertainment. So less transactional, more entertaining, more based on personality.
Do you see them as like fictionalized personalities? Or like, for example, I just posted an article about memorial bots and the conversation around the ethics of memorializing people who are deceased in artificial intelligence bots. Like, where is your head in this area?
Well, there are actually a lot of very interesting questions around this. So, you know, we actually are next month, we're going to actually host a workshop on the safety of conversational AI.
It's a fascinating space.
It's a fascinating space. And I think there are a lot of questions. And as an industry, we need to come together to figure out, like, what is the expectation? We also need to do a lot more user research, you know, understand, like, what people expect. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many different angles, right? One is, you know, is this AI expressing an opinion, or is it the opinion of the company that created this AI, right? And so it's a tricky problem, right? And, you know, you can try to stay in a safe realm where you don't really express opinion, but then mm-hmm. it's not much of a personality if you cannot express anything.
Right. Or it could be crowdsourced from all of the internet, right? Which would be a preference of the majority view, potentially.
That has a lot of challenges. And actually, I've been pretty vocal about these challenges recently, mm-hmm. you know, because I think that's not a good solution. Crowdsourced from the whole internet, you will get a lot of the biases on the internet. So you wouldn't want to just create an AI like this, which is what's happening today. Right? People just create this gigantic language model. And honestly, you know, it's very easy to make this model say very sexist and racist stuff, right? So you don't want that. You cannot just crawl the information. You have to do more work.
So this will be a curated conversation, or conversations based on highly curated inputs, potentially.
Right. It's unclear actually what the solution is. So first, we need to figure out what the objective is and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And I don't think there has been a very thoughtful reflection around this. Again, one extreme is you have an AI that has absolutely no opinion, right? Doesn't express anything. But we kind of all know that it would be a pretty boring system to interact with. The other extreme is what you might add is you get an AI, you just train it on the internet, and you're like, oh, okay, let it go wild. And hey, that's the expression of the internet. That's definitely not good enough, okay? We don't want that. It will not lead to good results. So the end result needs to be something in between. And we need to figure out, you know, how can we get something with personality yet is not offending or replicating biases that are out there in the training data. And that takes really thoughtfulness in understanding, you know, what are the expectations are from a user perspective, thoughtfulness from the research and as an industry coming together to define some standards, and thoughtfulness as, you know, how do we actually design the system and we train them, right?
Well, it sounds like at a minimum, having a personal assistant who remembers everything that you've ever told it perfectly, that seems like it could be potentially very helpful. Like, I would like to go back to that restaurant that I was at 5 years ago, and it'll remember and be able to book that for you, or remembering anniversaries. And there's plenty of uses.
That's right. We'll make progress around this. But then the question would be like, do you want that assistant to, you know, have a personality and give you some opinions as to the restaurant you want to go see, or just be like, you know, purely transactional and tell you exactly what you told it, right? So these are interesting questions that are not completely answered.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And then what about the visual usage? Like the point you made about being able to find your keys that you've misplaced, that would be very helpful for me, actually. What other uses could you anticipate or do you envision for the future?
I mean, there are actually some things that we'll actually deploy even before augmented reality, but One of them is commerce. You know, mm-hmm. imagine you go around and you cross paths with someone and they're wearing something that looks very attractive to you. You're like, hey,
I want that.
I want that. You know, I'm not much of a shopper myself. So, you know, but I do know some people really react to this. They see something out there, the cross path. So imagine you see a garment out there. You're like, oh, you know, I really like this. Where can I buy this? How does it look on me? Can you show me what it would look like? How do you combine that with other things I have in my wardrobe? So there's a lot of really use case around like discovering new products that you want to see. And that's something actually we can do today, not just through AR, but through things that are posted on social media. You know, like when people post pictures, can they become the catalog of the product they are wearing, right? So that the people, the small businesses that don't have the means to actually create a catalog basically get this catalog for free by just their user. So kind of a new way to interact with businesses, new way to shop is another example of what you could do visually.
So that's brilliant. I'm excited to see how that pans out.
You know, another example is what we also call like memory, right? So having something that can remember everything you see, right? And let you remember these moments, you know, recall them at will is something that could be pretty amazing, right? So as you go around your day, you have all this interaction with other people across all your life, being able to recall that moment, bring it back, share it with others, and do that all, you know, privately would be an amazing capability.
Yeah, so it sounds like an episode from Black Mirror potentially, but I love that you've added that will be done privately because that's incredible amounts of data.
No, it's actually a good point, right? So I think the key is not just do things because we can. Mm-hmm. We're really trying to rethink this, right? So I have actually in my team, one of the big focus we have is around responsible AI and really understanding what are the unforeseen potential consequences of what we're creating and making sure that as we design system, right, they really take into consideration all the aspects of responsibility. You know, can you do it privately? Can you do it fairly? Is it inclusive? Is it done transparently? Does it provide the right control to people? So it's a really important aspect. So as AI become more and more powerful, the problem I have is not that I need to justify AI or show that it can do things. You know, at Facebook, we have so many opportunities for application. We see the potential, we see this application, but the key is to do them in a way that really gives trust to the user. So we don't want to make, you know, AI things that people really worry about or are concerned about. So that's a big part of our reasoning or thinking. So that's why every time I tell you about these use cases in the future, a big part of thinking is how do you do that responsibly? How do you make sure that people will not have questions as they use the system, that it's not doing the right thing for them?
So I'm actually very familiar with the privacy space and also some of the work that Facebook's doing in this area. But for our listeners who are less familiar, can you talk a bit about what measures you're taking to create this world that is also deeply private and has fiduciary obligations or loyalties, I guess, to the user or the creator of the data?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Facebook thinking on privacy has evolved over the year. And we're really trying to show today that we are a responsible guardian of data. And one way to do that is to make sure that we use the data in a way that we told you we would, okay? So we make sure that as we collect data, we tell you clearly what it will be used for, right? And solely used for that. The other aspect is to develop techniques that don't require even to have access to that data, right? I don't know if you're using WhatsApp, but WhatsApp, for example, is a system that works completely with end-to-end encryption. So Facebook never gets access to that data, even if we wanted to, or if a government wants to ask us about it, we don't have access to that data. So more and more, we're thinking around, you know, this encrypted system, and that requires making the AI actually runs on device, right? So rather having a system that's done centrally than is done on device. There are also other techniques where you use what's called differential privacy, where a part of the data may be in the cloud, but in a way that's not really usable, accessible. And then some of the computation is done on the device so that when you really need to have the higher accuracy, then you do it on the device with the additional data provided by the user, but that only the user on their device can see, but not the central server.
Right, right. And I definitely think the needle is moving here. I've actually had people recommend WhatsApp to me because they feel that it's one of the more secure options.
That's right. And so Facebook is really, really serious about privacy. And we made mistakes in the past. I think the company has done, had some missteps clearly. You know, everybody's aware of that. And our goal really is the next years to make sure that people have confidence in our system and know that we have privacy at heart.
So we've touched on the work that you guys are doing to build some of these intelligent systems. And I'm curious what you think are going to be the hardest problems to solve and what it will take to reach human level intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, I usually like to talk about human level intelligence. I mean, we know what human level intelligence is. I'm not sure we know what AGI means. I think it's a bit of a
misnomer.
Yeah, misnomer, because you know, human intelligence is not general, right? We are actually very biased towards the world we live in. You know, we're optimized to live in one world. We're not a general intelligence that will work, you know, anywhere. If I put you on another planet, I doubt you will actually survive easily. So, you know, I like to talk about human level intelligence. And I think, you know, one of the big challenge is, you know, can we learn more like humans do? If you look at the early moments of life or the early years of life, right? You don't go through this moment with a teacher alongside you to tell you like, do this and don't do that, right? Initially, actually, even the first, you know, year of life, we basically don't get much supervision, right? We're just observing around, looking how the world behaves. So we believe that's actually a big intuition as to how our system should learn, you know. They should learn in a self-supervised way rather than in a supervised way, right? So by just observing the world, you find the regularities, you figure out, hey, there's things that really can happen, and others you figure out very quickly don't happen, right? So it gives you like an intuition. And we believe that actually, you know, animals and humans early in life go through this very quickly, which train their brain very efficiently. Whereas today, most of the system we put out there are trained with this humongous amount of supervision, which is like, okay, as if they had, you know, millions of hours of classroom, but humans don't learn this way. So we believe that's an intuition as to how we should learn in a much more, you know, unsupervised way, self-supervised way, by just kind of observing all data and extracting all the information from that data. So then in some way, all the system we create, you know, give a feedback to the system that's very, very little. If you take reinforcement learning, it's just telling you like, oh, it's good or bad, right? Or if you take supervision, it's like, oh, it's the right class or the wrong class. But actually, when you observe the world around you, you get a tremendous amount of information. Like, you know that something is like, you know, the potential that can play out is very limited towards all the things that could, in theory, happen, right? You know, if you look at the physics of the world, right, it's a very constrained world. You know, you're not going to have like something appearing out of nowhere. You have continuity. You know how the objects behave, and they tend to behave very similarly across time. So that's the kind of intuition to make AI system that will have a much more human intelligence and have, you know, things like common sense, which today, you know, the systems don't have.
Right. And why don't they have common sense? Like, what is the barrier to teaching them that?
That's a big question. If I had that answer, you know, you know, we would be much further ahead, you know. No, I do think that one reason is because we are not extracting all the information from what we are observing today. When I'm saying we, I mean the computer system we are creating, whereas humans do that very efficiently, right? So they learn very efficiently from the data that's put around. Like they see what are the kind of like, you know, laws of the world around them, and they've learned them and they can predict them. And so they're very information efficient in what they can learn from what's out there, right? So that's what people start talking about, you know, zero-shot learning, one-shot learning, mm-hmm. learning by sheer example, right? I mean, if humans get hurt in one way, they'll learn immediately that they shouldn't do it again. And that's one of the jokes that Jan makes sometimes. You know, Jan LeCun, my team, he says, you know, if a car had to learn to self-drive through reinforcement learning, you'd have to have 3 million accidents before you get a self-driving car, which obviously we can't do, right? So you need to create a system that can learn very quickly from unseen situations.
Is that a matter of giving the machines enough of a corpus of background information, the way that, you know, a child comes to the learning table with all the DNA, it's already programmed into it?
Well, I think there's two aspects. I don't think it's a matter of just amount of information, okay, provided. I do think there's a question of like different kind of learning algorithms. I mean, the question you raise is interesting, which is, hey, when people learn early in life, did they actually not learn it in their early life, but did they actually accumulate all the learning of their ancestors through, you know, their DNA? I think that's a good question. I do believe it's both, but the learning that's done through DNA is very inefficient, right? So evolution is a very slow process where, you know, animals encode kind of learning over time. But if you have to die to actually get create learning, or like the species, or like a whole, you know, it's not a very efficient process. So I think it's an interesting question, whether it's the same kind of learning or it's a kind of like architecture search, if you want. And some people think that the learning that happens, like the DNA learning, if you want, is some kind of architecture search. And then when you're born, you have this architecture, and then that's the architecture that's very well suited to learn from the world and the environment you have around you.
So, I mean, similar with GPT-3, like one of the reasons why few-shot learning seems to be working there is that it's been trained on so much information and data, but we have to close those gaps still, that we have to bridge the information with the new inputs so that there's more than that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this large language model, I mean, what they really know is an interesting question, right? So they are able to find patterns, right? They're not just accuracy memorizing, right? So they're looking at all the information, all that knowledge out there. They find some kind of deeper patterns, which make them understand and kind of like the concepts behind that in a rough manner. And then they are able to create language that kind of show these patterns. But it's not the same as really deeply understanding the relationship. I mean, I think what's happening when you look at the system is it's very easy to find some like weird biases that they have towards one another. We talked about earlier, you know, about like, hey, reproducing like the biases of the internet. But it's actually what people underestimate is how complicated it is to fix that. Because it would mean that the system doesn't just regurgitate some pieces that it has on there, is that more it has like a coherent vision of the world, right? Which GPT-3 doesn't have. Right? It's actually, if you interact with it, right, one moment it will have one personality, the other it will have another one, right? And actually creating this consistent view is a lot more complicated than people assume, you know, and making sure that it's not just regurgitating, like telling you back what it has found from one piece of the internet or the other is actually, I think, a lot more complicated than what people think. And it will require, you know, creating a system where you can have guarantees in it that what it's giving you back is actually valid information, right? Which today you have no guarantees when you use a system like this.
So what is the most exciting aspect of artificial intelligence in the future to you? If you were to pick one thing, like the most interesting thing that excites you about the direction of this field, what would that be?
I would say for me, it's three things. You know, one is what I mentioned, creating these completely novel experiences with AI at the core. And ultimately, this is about having a much more natural interaction with the computer, right? So if you look at our interaction with the computer, a great example is a QWERTY keyboard, right? It's an awful interface, right? So we've been trained to use a keyboard that was actually designed to slow us down, you know, typing and this kind of interaction, not great. So I think the future will make our interaction with this computer much more natural, much more like human-like in the way we want it, not the computer wants it, right? So in the past 20 years, we have adapted to computers. I think in the next 20 years, the computers will adapt to us and they will open a whole new round of experiences. The second thing that excites me is around creativity. You know, it's to create AI that allows people to be a lot more creative. You know, in some way, when you're doing art today, right, you have this concept of 10,000 hours, you have to learn the technique. But you may have internally like the creative impetus, but it's hard to unleash that, you know, without actually taking a lot of time learning the technique. And I believe AI can help with this, right? So, you know, unleash your creative potential without requiring you to learn the technique, you know, make technique more irrelevant for creation. So I think that'd be very exciting.
Like providing potentially scaffolding or a sounding board.
Yeah, or even some tools that take your input, you know, creatively and compose it, you know, let you sing without maybe singing exactly properly, let you compose music without knowing, let you create much better pictures automatically by adapting to the subject you're putting to. So I think there's a lot of potential. Create better videos, create better stories. I think there's a lot of potential. Or new forms of expression that we don't know yet. So I think that's a big potential.
I'm a novelist and I've spent time with GPT-3 and kind of, you know, bouncing off of like a critique partner just to see what it can do. That actually is helpful. But, you know, I'm curious if you're in the camp of AI being a creator itself or more of an enabler of human creativity.
Actually, it's an interesting one. I mean, if you interact with GPT-3, I mean, if you've done it, it's kind of fun, but then you can see how it's formulaic after a while, right? So it's much less creative than people think. But I do believe that you can create a system tool, right? So this is a bit of my dream, right? Is to have this tool where the kind of creative spark is what comes from the human, where all the technicality before comes before. And, you know, there was this op-ed created by GPT-3 in The Guardian. I don't know if you saw that just recently.
I think I saw that, yep.
But people don't understand. They're like, oh, we put it together and then we edited it. And they don't realize that's a huge thing to do. And it's great to do it this way. And I think in the future, hopefully we'll do a lot more of that, which is like, hey, you get something that kind of write the sentences for you. You don't have to kind of wordsmith this too much and stuff. But ultimately putting it together, that's the creative piece, right? This is where really human will come together, the bigger intent. So I think people overestimate like the creative part, but I do think there is a lot of potential in assisting. And the third for me is really change the narrative around innovation. I think that's something I feel is maybe the most important thing I could do as an impact is I feel like the tech industry as a whole has kind of ignored its responsibility in the past or been a bit too cavalier. And I really don't want that to happen to AI, and creating a technology that's a lot more inclusive, much more fair, much more transparent, and include that in the design of that technology rather than afterthought, right? So rather than creating technology and then, you know, dealing with the consequences, think of this consequence inherently and inherently make the technology better for humans. So I think this change of thinking, taking responsibility at heart, putting it as the part of the creation process rather than, you know, cleaning up after the fact, is something that has huge potential.
That is, does have huge potential. It's like you want to build it right from the ground up. But what do you say then, because this is one of those controversial aspects in the field, what do you say to the individual developer or the startup company that's just trying to survive and they don't feel that they have time to solve all the problems of the world with their technology?
I don't mean to be like a party pooper here. It's not like, oh, okay, you know, you got to think of all these things so you cannot innovate anymore. I think if you put that at the heart, you will come with a better innovation, actually. So I don't think it has to slow you down. Actually, it's kind of a different definition of better. And I think it allows you to create AI that has more impact. And so I do believe it will actually be a differentiator. So, you know, the wrong way to think about this is like, oh, I've got to think of all this responsibility and it's going to slow me down. It's like, hey, let me put responsibility at the heart. Let me bring also different people to conceive this AI. And it will be actually a competitive differentiator.
A better product.
Yeah, better product, yes.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I'd love to ask you two more personal questions. Like, what is it that motivates you in your work in this space? And then maybe going backwards in time, what was the first spark of your interest in artificial intelligence?
What motivates me, you know, is I want to have positive impact in the world, right? And technology has shown a lot of impact. And what I want to make sure that that impact is really positive. And Facebook is an amazing place to do this. I mean, it's obviously a place where we've had tremendous impact. We've grown tremendously. But then we realized that, hey, we have, you know, impact that we didn't know about. And we need to be a lot more responsible about it. So for me, that's why I really like this job. And I like where I am, because I can make a difference in making sure that we are using AI responsibly. The second is, as an industry also, I'd love to make that change, you know, making sure that we do innovation in a responsible way. We also bring in new people into that fold. I do believe that it will be an essential part of solving that problem, is like having a different kind of demographics of people developing AI today. We are not a very diverse field, and I really, really want to change that. So that's what really motivates me in the morning. One is I want to have, you know, positive impact within Facebook and within the world. And then I want to really make our field much more diverse and responsible. Now, for your second question, which was 25 years ago, what, you know, brought me to this field was actually understanding human intelligence. I came through it through cognitive science and philosophy. I really wanted to understand, you know, the human brain. And what I find fascinating is, having studied philosophy when I was young, it's really interesting to touch a field like this that has such relevance to understanding humans, while being very practical at the same time, right? It has an impact on the world. It's not just some philosophical thoughts about, you know, what it could be. It's really kind of changing our world today.
And you're doing that now. It's amazing. Did you know you would be here 22 years ago when you had that first spark? Did you know you'd be here today? Where did you think you were headed?
Well, I started as a mathematician, so I thought I would be doing research in mathematics. You know? That was my initial thing. Then I realized that, hey, when I did my PhD, only 5 people read my PhD. You know, I did a PhD in arithmetic geometry, you know, one of the most obscure, you know, around the Fermat. At the time, it was actually a Fermat conjecture. Now it's a theorem. Someone proved it. So I had to change field, you know, do something else. But.
Right. And that's actually the reason why I decided not to be a law professor, is I think 5 people read my law article.
Yeah. So here it's almost the complete opposite, right? You really touch a lot of people and you have a very high responsibility.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you want to leave with our listeners before we end here?
No, I just want to reiterate what I said, right? I think it's amazing what's happening today with AI. There's just no question. It is changing a lot of things. There's always too much buzz around these things, but it is happening, you know, like AI is having an impact. It's really changing the way we do things. And, you know, my message is we need to make sure we do this responsibly, and we need to really take into account all the consequences of what we're creating and make sure that we do it better for people. It will make our research better. It will make startups better. It will make companies like Facebook better if we can do that.
Well, Jerome, thank you. This has been so exciting to hear about all the new innovations underway. I'm really looking forward to seeing the many things that will come out of your lab. So thanks again for taking the time to be with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to another special Q&A for Intel's AI Builders program. I'm Abigail Heng-Wen, and I'm here with Dr. Sam Small, Chief Security Officer for ZeroFox. I'm looking forward to hearing more about his work in internet security, to talk about social media and his work with Intel. Sam, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Abigail, for having me.
Let's start off with just hearing more about ZeroFox. Tell me about the inspiration, the history of the organization, and your role there.
Sure. So I'm the Chief Security Officer at ZeroFox, and we're a company based in Baltimore, Maryland, although we have offices around the world. And our company was started in 2013, and we were really the first security-focused offering targeted toward social media protection. At the time, this was pretty unique. And even though social media had been around for a number of years before the company was founded, there wasn't really a widespread corporate understanding of the risks and potential issues that may put businesses or their customers or their employees in sight of attackers, and how to detect those sorts of issues and how to prevent those sorts of issues. So the kernel of innovation really for ZeroFox came from that observation. And so as time has grown, so has our view and strategy and vision of what security should look like beyond the traditional idea of a corporate perimeter. And our company has grown to reflect the reality that the world has changed the way that it communicates, not only on a peer-to-peer basis, but for businesses with their consumers. And so today, it's really not odd at all to have this type of offering or solution in a enterprise security risk management program.
How is social media changing the landscape of business communications today?
I think before social media became so widespread or mainstream, you would see an internet where if people wanted to learn more about your business or interact with your business, they had to directly visit your website, typically the name of your business.com or what have you. And while effective, if you had a strong brand or if people knew about your business, other than advertising, there was really no way for consumers to necessarily even understand that you existed, let alone interact with you. And so as social media became more popular and businesses became more savvy in interacting with that technology, we saw that consumers really took to this platform where you were able to interact with your customers and respond to inquiries or customer service issues, or you're able to more dynamically understand how they feel about your brand or your customer service, or give you opportunities to have a more regular and authentic interaction and voice with those communities.
What are you finding are some of the unique challenges that are posed on the security side for this type of interaction?
Maybe one of the primary challenges is really authenticity, primarily around identification or identity, really. So for most social media platforms, it doesn't cost anything nor require any validation to create an account that has a certain name, whether that be an individual's name or whether that be the name of a business or a brand. And again, typically when you create an account on one of these platforms, you upload an image or an icon or an avatar. It could be a logo for your brand. It could be the image of a person. And unfortunately, it's very easy to pretend to be someone else or to pretend to be something else. And the primary currency in social media engagement is an implicit trust of authenticity that however someone presents themselves reflects the reality of who they are. And we know and we've seen after numerous attacks and headlines in the media that that's not always the case. And so I think that ultimately leads to a lot of challenges that become bigger security risks as they fall downhill. And I don't think this is too different than what we see even in something as well known and as old of a phenomenon as email phishing as well, where you receive an email from someone and it says it's from someone that you know or from a brand that you've interacted with before, but maybe upon closer inspection, some of the details don't quite add up. So I think this is really just an analogy to that. However, in this case with social media, where you have these images and you have a history of communication, it can be even more difficult for someone to discern whether activity or identity matches the actor behind it.
So can you give us a specific example, maybe from your work or from headlines, of an incident where this may have actually been damaging to a business or its brand?
Sure, happy to. So one thing we see quite often is social media becomes a venting place for people, whether or not they've had a great experience with a brand or a product or a negative one. And so whenever emotions run high, often people feel compelled for whatever reason to reach for their phones and tweet out, you know, their experience with an organization, a company, a brand, a product, et cetera. And when this happens, the more savvy organizations will have a social media team that is paying attention to messages that are either directed towards them or that mention their brand or their product, and will respond to engage with that customer or those voices. And if there are issues, to try to help rectify the situation or prevent someone's bad experience from going viral and making it look like the company doesn't care or is unable to deliver on the products and goods that they offer. And so this has been an effective use of social media, but this has also opened the door for attackers who are using impersonating accounts to also immediately respond or react to these individual complaints or applause. And so one thing that we often see, especially in the financial services industry, is someone will post a comment or a piece of content related to one of these experiences. One of these impersonating accounts will offer to help them by providing them with a link where they can receive additional help or tell them to direct message them for further assistance. And then from there, we have all of the traditional security issues we would normally expect to see, maybe a phishing link, maybe someone who's pretending to be a customer service representative asking for account information that shouldn't be shared, et cetera. And then these things play out just like any traditional security threat would from that point forward.
Got it. So with social media then, if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like the additional challenge is there's potentially more ways of getting at the customer because it's all played out on the world stage, and phishing attackers, they can come alongside the authentic voices and do their thing.
That's right. And many of these platforms have a concept of verification around accounts. So that can provide some sense of confidence or security.
Right. Like Instagram and Twitter have the check marks.
Yeah, exactly. However, unfortunately, those programs aren't always available to every business that wants to participate. And not every user of those platforms is sophisticated enough to recognize those indicators in the user interface. So that alone is not enough to protect us, unfortunately.
And what is ZeroFox? What is their solution for these security threats?
So with ZeroFox, what we do is we work with our customers to help understand what their business risks are across digital platforms. And then we monitor for any activity that involves any of those assets or attributes. So that could be any kind of content that relates to the particular name of the company, brands or products that they have, executives or ambassadors, locations, et cetera. And anytime we identify any posts or content or information that mentions the business, we use our technology platform to analyze that content and determine if there is a risk associated with it. So obviously, if people are posting about your business and it's more informational, or it's just expressing, you know, some sort of sentiment, that isn't necessarily something that is going to create a cause for alarm or eventually create an alert in our platform. However, in those cases where someone is mentioning a business and it's coming from an account that claims to, you know, represent the organization, and we know that that's not one of the official channels for the business, we can identify that and bring that to our customers' attention. We can identify adversaries or actors, rather, posting things on official company digital assets, whether they be Twitter pages or Facebook business pages or Instagram pages that are enticing their followers or customers to engage in risky behavior by either clicking on links or following instructions that would lead to some sort of cyber risk, et cetera. So across all of these various use cases, ZeroFox is able to proactively and in near real time identify, analyze, and in many cases, mitigate or remediate these issues to give our customers confidence that these security risks are not only going to protect the business and its operations and its employees, but their customers and potential customers as well.
Can you talk about how ZeroFox's solution has helped a specific customer?
Happy to. So we have one customer that is an internet first bank. And so they don't have any physical branches, and they do all of their marketing and advertising online, and all of the engagement and interaction that they have with their customers in conducting transactions as well is all done online. Now, this organization has an international footprint, and because it's in the financial industry, there's money involved, clearly, and attackers are interested in money. So unfortunately, this customer is frequently targeted by attackers using traditional security threats and things that are more modern, that are more based in the space that we're talking about across digital platforms and social media. And one of the issues they face in particular is not just that these attacks are taking place, but the scale at which they take place. And so, for instance, you might imagine that it's one thing to try to identify an impersonating account on a social media platform or an impersonating domain name that's been registered on the web on a daily basis. But when there are potentially thousands of these popping up every day, the security team at this organization has a real challenge in classifying and prioritizing which of these risks should be addressed first and which have the potential to cause the most damage. And so when we partnered with this particular bank, what we were able to do is define exactly what the indicators of an impersonation or fraud would look like against their various brands and offerings. And then as all of these alerts came through our platform, we were able to prioritize them based on whether or not the domain was simply parked or whether or not it actually had content that looked like it came directly from the customer's website. We used computer vision to determine if any of the images on these websites or any of the images posted on these accounts on Instagram or on Twitter used company branding, whether that be, again, logos or pictures of ambassadors or executives. And then once we were able to do those things, we're able to prioritize, categorize, and begin to run takedown playbooks across the most dangerous artifacts that we saw. So what this might mean for a website that's impersonating their customer login portal, that might mean we go directly to the domain registrar and we go directly to the web host and we go directly to any other pieces of infrastructure that are used to host that site and we submit takedown requests. And in the meantime, what we also do is we submit those sites and those indicators to every security blacklist that's available and that could potentially block that site from ever being loaded in a browser. Likewise, we immediately reach out to every single social media platform or digital platform where these risks are taking place, and we automatically package the artifacts and information to make the investigation as simple as possible for these platform security teams to recognize that, yes, this is a piece of content that violates our terms of service, that is clearly trying to entice users to engage in risky behavior, and that is impersonating an authentic business on our platform. And so end to end, what ZeroFox is able to provide is that near real-time identification of these risks all the way through the classification and the removal or mitigation of these threats across the web. And so again, we've been able to do this at a volume and a scale that is just not possible with a human security team. And we're able to leverage advanced technologies to do this in a way that is extremely efficient and affordable.
Great. So identification, classification, removal at scale. And how are you working with Intel to carry out your work?
So we joined the Intel Builders Program last year. And very quickly, we found that by moving some of our computer vision detection software to the OpenVINO toolkit, that we were able to experience dramatic increases in performance. So as far as some of our computer vision algorithms and object detection algorithms that are based on OpenVINO toolkit, we were seeing improvements up to 2 to 3 times faster than what we were using with industry standard frameworks and libraries. And so what this allowed us to do is generate alerts for risky content to our customers up to twice as fast as we were able to do so before. Another thing that we've done with Intel is consult with their engineers on the architectures that we're using in our deep learning algorithms to, again, provide architectural performance improvements that we're then able to put into practice through the OpenVINO toolkit and by optimizing for performance on Intel Xeon processors.
I wanted to kind of move the conversation a little bit outside of the box of what we've been talking about. With the upcoming U.S. elections, how important is social media security going to be to politics? And I think we both agree it's going to be very important. And what is ZeroFox doing to help keep our political system secure?
I don't think it's a controversial thing for me to say that people are receiving more and more news and information through social media first today than they maybe would have traditionally through print media or TV media in the past.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think even my teammates, when we talk about where they're getting their AI news, a lot of them get it on Twitter.
Exactly. Whether it's explicitly subscribing to information by following a certain entity, or maybe more implicitly or passively subscribing to a particular worldview or perspective by following others, whether they be influencers or even just friends who post frequently, that is usually a primary source of attention for people today because it's just so easy to pull open the app and scroll to your heart's content or maybe not content. So I would say, you know, as the election approaches, I think the intensity of the messaging and the excitement builds. And the risk here is that information that might not be accurate or information that might be skewed towards a particular party's perspective, and I'm not necessarily talking about a political party, that could be any party, anyone who has a stake in the outcome of that election, is a risk that needs to be addressed and is something that we should all be aware of, that we have to ask ourselves when we look at information, you know, what is the incentive of this source that I'm receiving this information from? And does this information sound reputable or believable? And perhaps if it is something that is particularly compelling to some emotion that I'm having, should I perhaps seek a second opinion or an alternative perspective from which to view this information or verify its accuracy? And this becomes even more difficult on social media because it's not difficult to doctor anything. You can attribute a quote to someone even if they never said it. You can make a image that looks like it came from a screen capture of Fox News or CNN, even if that didn't take place. And even worse today, with the advent of deep fakes, we can create video and audio that looks like it authentically took place, even though it's completely synthetic. And so as attackers and these techniques become more sophisticated, this continues to challenge our ability to believe that what we perceive is in truth reality.
Absolutely. And I think even just putting this information out there, the risks that are still there and encouraging people to self-police their own social media and the content that they're consuming, that's a really important part of keeping everyone safe. As my last question, what do you think a cyber attack in the future would look like and how might the industry prepare themselves for these?
So I don't know if any of your listeners have seen any deepfake videos or heard any deepfake audio samples, but they range in sophistication. And some of the ones that have been created for media stories that have leveraged a lot of resources and professionals to make it as believable as possible gives us some clue and insight as to what is going to fall downstream in the near future. So my prediction is that in the next 3 to 5 years, it will be easy for almost any adversary to create professional and believable deepfake content at scale, targeting any business around the world, whether large or small, or any individual, whether they be a world leader or a small business leader.
So our attackers will be more sophisticated and targeting potentially more people at scale.
That's right. And again, I think, you know, there's an old adage of seeing is believing. And I think for thousands of years, there's been a lot of truth in that. And unfortunately, it's that adage that's under attack by these deep fake advancements. And so what happens when we live in a world when you see something with your own eyes, a video, right? Like I saw it happen, but it didn't in fact happen. And even putting that question in someone's mind of when they watch something that truly does happen, you know, being able to make them ask themselves, well, is what you saw really true or not? I mean, that's a scary philosophical societal issue that we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, it undermines a lot of credibility. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Sam, for joining me today. It's been really fun to hear about ZeroFox's work and your work. And I'm thankful for all that you guys are doing to make the internet a safer place for all of us to be using.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and your audience. And I also want to express the appreciation of everyone at ZeroFox for the help Intel has given us in improving our product and delivering it to customers.
That's fantastic. Thanks again, Sam.
Thank you.